No, it's like getting there, it's getting there, you know. My classes are really good. I just didn't have time to knit. Oh. It's just as much as that. So it's less than a half. I think it's a lot less than a half. Because it's like not this long.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh my god, what are you doing? It's really, really young. So, like, kind of abstract ideas are much more absorbable. But for example, learning halakha, you couldn't do that because in halakha you have to have a very practical mind.
Yeah.
But if you're sitting on the chassidut or something, yeah, and you're basically like, you know, someone lecturing, then yeah, it's different. Like, for example, we had that class with the Bayanet today, and it was just specific because we needed to take notes.
Yeah.
Because it was something, just it was short, it was very specific. Whereas if you talk about concepts,
yeah,
this is amazing.
Really?
Yeah. As soon as we should set up in groups, stitch and bitch. Yeah. I can go with you and get some yarn, because I need more anyway, so I know why.
I've seen the place
where
it's like right in
Yeah, that's the one. We go there because it's quite cheap.
Oh, yeah?
And they have very good quality, yeah.
Well, then
you go. Yeah, they have all the equipment. Mm-hmm. So nice. And then we can go to Bani Yehuda to Katzefa and have the most amazing smoothies.
But you're like...
Yeah. Dangerous for me to be like, what I really like. So I end up going there.
Am I assuming this is it today, or should I?
I'm sure there's...
Okay, I'll wait a few more minutes. Okay.
We know that for sure one more is coming.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Hope you enjoyed your one-day Hanukkah vacation, was it?
No, Sunday. We had a couple of days.
It's Sunday to Monday, that's what it said in the Sunday.
Monday.
No, it was actually from Thursday, half day.
Oh, because the calendar
says... Yes, Sunday, Monday, okay. Tuesday, and on Tuesday we're back for the evening class.
Okay.
It wasn't actually the class, we were just calling everyone for the campaign and trying to raise the...
Yeah, I thought I would come back, I thought I would see a fancy new campus here, you know, with all that money.
We were hoping the same thing,
yeah, this is just for men.
For the men, okay.
We're the backbone for men to have the campus.
So you did the phone calls and they get the money.
And okay. Yeah, they'll get the
okay.
money.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll get something.
Okay. That could probably love me, it was the big picture.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. This is cute.
Yeah. I mean, he looked so friendly on that picture. I know. He looked like that whoever guy, America wants you or something. The one listing people to the army.
Uncle Sam.
Maybe.
America wants you. The army wants you.
Yeah. Right. So I like those Uncle Sam, and we had Uncle Joe on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You're so stunning.
Uncle Joe, right.
Right.
Yeah, we America had the better side of the deal. Although, you know, this is a famous information in the Chabad movement that you probably heard of a different shiurim, that when Napoleon was invading Russia,
yes,
the Alter Rebbe said we should pray for the Tsar, not for Napoleon, even though Napoleon gave emancipation and freedom to the Jews, and the Tsar was very oppressive. The Alter Rebbe felt that spiritually, all of the freedoms would take the Jews away from Torah, which in fact happened. The
just
reform
like
movement,
right.
So he said, the Tsar is destroying us in body, but at least we remain strong.
Wow.
Yeah. So other Hasidic rabbis, there was a machlokas among the Hasidic rabbis of Europe. Mm-hmm. Who should you pray for?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you've ever seen Fiddler on the Roof, but there was a question.
Yeah.
Rabbi, can you tell us, is there a proper blessing for the Tsar?
Mm-hmm.
And Rabbi replied, yes, Leibish. What was the blessing? May Hashem bless and keep the Tsar far away from us.
Keep far away.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you know, Rabbi Redwood, do you know the Alex family? David Alex?
Yes, I do. Sure. Oh, that's right. He had mentioned to me that he had... were you over his house for Shabbos?
Yeah, I was.
He had mentioned some of my younger girls were over there for Shabbos.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's very sweet couple.
Yeah, they're very nice. I've known them for a lot of years.
Oh, you know them from the States?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your favorite Larissa isn't here. She's in the States for three weeks? Yeah. Or a month? Yeah. No, three weeks, I think. And many girls actually went home, so. Mm.
Okay. All right.
There'll be some more girls.
Okay, I just want to be sure. We do have class tonight. I'm not, okay. I don't want
to.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
We're here. Okay, no, Baruch Hashem, you know. They tell a story about a great Rosh Hashiva after the war, after World War II. He had like three students in front of him, and he was gesticulating and you know, like talking very loudly and excitedly and passionately, as if he was giving a share to a very, very big audience. So someone asked him afterwards, "You only had like two or three people. What's the big deal?" He says, "I'm not just teaching them. I'm teaching their children, their grandchildren, their future."
That's beautiful.
Says, so teaching of Torah is intergenerational. So, you know, yeah. You can be teaching one person, and, you know, you never know the ripple effect.
You may not know we have a kala.
Mazel tov. Wonderful.
Talking about children.
That's wonderful. Fantastic. Your chassan is from here or from?
We're both from San Diego, but he goes to the men's program.
Very nice. So it should be a Shah Tova, and should be, have a Vice Nema be Israel, and you're planning, hoping on living in Israel?
One day, I hope.
But in the short term, you go back to... Oh, yes, yes, thank you, thank you.
We're going to get married here. Study here for a few months, and then
it's still
back.
Okay.
Yeah, and what do I just play? What do I just play?
You just play.
Yeah, that's this. Yeah.
No problem.
Okay, hello, everybody. Good to see you, and it's been a while, and I'll try to remember what the last thing we were talking about was. I think I know. Baruch Hashem, you had a spiritual holiday of Hanukkah. You raised a lot of money, got engaged, so a lot of good things. A lot of good things happened.
Yeah.
Baruch Hashem, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu should continue. As you know, this Tuesday is a Tainis, is a fast day, the 10th of Teves, and the 10th of Teves is a bit obscure. It actually is part of 3 days of mourning, but the 3 days are not directly connected. There's the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th of Teves, our sad, tragic days. But we only fast on one day because Chazal don't want to be too strict on us to make two. It'd be hard to fast 3 days in a row. The 10th day of Teves was the day that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylonia, began the siege against Jerusalem. And that lasted for 3.5 years till the 9th of Av, 3 years later. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So this is the beginning, chronologically, this is the first of the events connected to the Beis HaMikdash. It's not the first in the year. Tzom Gedalia is earlier in the year, but in terms of the chronology, this is the earliest events connected to the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. According to a number of sources, just a little introduction. According to a number of sources, the Chassam Sofer writes that every 10th of Teves, Hashem decides if the Beis, like Rosh Hashanah, Hashem decides if the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt this year. So it's a very, very significant day. It's the Yom HaDin.
What do we have to do?
So you have to do. So we have to do tshuva and resolve. You know, the 10th of Teves, Tuesday. Tuesday is a fast day, but I want you to know it's not just a fast day. It is said to be the day of judgment on whether the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt.
Each and every single person,
no, because that's Rosh Hashanah. No, it's not the individual Rosh Hashanah. It's the Beis HaMikdash Rosh Hashanah. The other thing to know is that some Sfarim assert that Asara B'Teves was the day that Yosef was sold by his brothers. So it's connected that the Chorban Beis HaMikdash is rooted in the hatred that Yosef's brothers showed to Yosef. Just as we know, the whole Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. And therefore, when you ask, what do? Is you try to rectify the sin of Mechiras Yosef. Now, the sin of Mechiras Yosef was Sinas Chinam. Therefore, we rectify it with Abbas Yisrael, right? That's exactly, particularly what we do on the 10th day of Teves. Because of this, there's a teaching from the Avudraham. Avudraham is one of the medieval authorities, Rishonim we call them, like right, you know, late Rishonim. The Avudraham actually says that, you know, we know if every fast falls out on Shabbos, except for Yom Kippur, We never fast on Shabbos. If Tisha B'Av falls out on Shabbos, we do not fast on Shabbos. But theoretically, if Asara B'Teves would fall out on Shabbos, we would fast even on Shabbos. That's how important it is. Now, the reason why I say it's theoretically is it's an untestable proposition, because based on our calendar, the 10th of Teves can never be on Shabbos. So you'll never... On the other hand, it can be on Friday.
Yeah, it was like 3 days.
That's right. And this is the only fast day, so in a way you kind of see it, that you actually fast on Friday. You know, if the fast of Esther is on Friday, we fast on Thursday. We don't fast on Friday because we don't want to enter Shabbos feeling starving or hungry. But the 10th of Teves is very, very strange. You actually fast until Shabbos begins. Huh?
Why wouldn't I fast?
Well, because it all depends on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah cannot fall on Sunday, Wednesday, Friday. That's the rule of the calendar. You'll see, Rosh Hashanah never falls on first day of Rosh Hashanah, never falls on Sunday, Wednesday, Friday. If you're interested, I'll tell you why that's so. But given that reality, if you just add the number of days until the 10th of Teves, it'll never be on Shabbos, because if Rosh Hashanah cannot fall on certain days, then the 10th of Teves cannot fall on certain days, because there will be X number of days from Rosh Hashanah to the 10th of Teves. Now why Rosh Hashanah cannot be on it's called Adu, like the French word adio, but Adu is Aleph, Dalet, Vav. Rosh Hashanah cannot be on Sunday, first day this is. Rosh Hashanah cannot be on Wednesday. Rosh Hashanah cannot be on Friday, the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Lo Adu Rosh. Rosh Hashanah cannot be on Adu. Now the reason that's so, let me take a Sunday and Friday first. Wednesday is a little more. If Rosh Hashanah, let's take Friday and Wednesday. Those two I can explain easily. If Rosh Hashanah would be on Wednesday, what day of the week would Yom Kippur be? Because of Friday. So you never want Yom Kippur to be on a Friday or a Sunday. You never want it to be before Shabbos or after Shabbos. And the reason is because if, God forbid, there's a dead body, and in the time of Chazal, a body would decompose. There was no refrigeration. You didn't want to have 2 days where you couldn't bury the dead. See, with a two-day Yom Tov, that's not a problem, because technically on the second day of Yom Tov, you are allowed to bury the dead. But on Shabbos you cannot, and on Yom Kippur you cannot. Therefore, Chazal, when they made the Jewish calendar, they made it that Yom Kippur can never be Friday or Sunday. Since Yom Kippur cannot be Friday or Sunday, then by definition, Rosh Hashanah cannot be Wednesday or Friday. Because if Rosh Hashanah would be Wednesday, Yom Kippur would be Friday. If Rosh Hashanah would be Friday, Yom Kippur would be Sunday. Do you see how that works? Because
I thought there were 10 days.
Yeah, there are 10 days, so that's exactly right.
Friday to Sunday?
No, Friday to Sunday is 10 days. Yom Kippur, they're not 10 days in between. Yom Kippur is the 10th day. So the 10th day would be Sunday. Yep. Now, why can't Rosh Hashanah be on Sunday? The Yom Kippur reason wouldn't be a reason, because then Yom Kippur would just be on Tuesday. That's fine. That's another reason. If Rosh Hashanah is on Sunday, then Hoshana Rabbah, which is the 21st day of the month, the 7th day of Sukkot, would be on Shabbos. And we don't want that, because then we wouldn't be able to shake the willow and hit the willow. And that's such an important mitzvah that the Chachamim didn't want to take that away from us.
Is it a mitzvah to hit the willow?
It is absolutely a mitzvah to hit the willow. Now, not a Torah commandment, but it is a mitzvah that was enacted by the Nevi'im, by the prophets. Yeah, it is a great mitzvah. And Kabbalistically, it sweetens the judgments. It's a very, very important thing. It's so important that the Chachamim arranged the whole calendar that would never come out on Shabbos, so you'll always be able to do it, right? Now, it's important to understand, just again, I'm going a little off topic, but okay, but it's good for your general knowledge, that in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, there was no calendar. Rosh Chodesh was whenever witnesses came and testified, they saw the new moon. So in the original way it worked, Rosh Hashanah could be any day of the week, whenever the witnesses came. So Rosh Hashanah could have been on a Sunday, on a Wednesday, and a Friday. This rule that Rosh Hashanah can only be on certain days dates from a time after the destruction of the temple, when the Chachamim made a calendar that was figured out instead of relying on witnesses. And then they made certain rules. So even if the new moon appears, what that means is, even if the new moon appears on Monday, which is Sunday night, the calendar basically says we make Rosh Hashanah the next day. These are called, there's a word for that, these are called dechios. Dechios means pushing off. Pushing off. And this is fundamental. So lo adu rosh, meaning Rosh Hashanah will not be on Sunday, Wednesday, Friday, first day of Rosh Hashanah. That is the most fundamental rule of the Jewish calendar. There are other dechios as well. But you understand that there's a domino effect. Once you've decided, not you, but once the Chachamim decided that Rosh Hashanah cannot fall on certain days, then for the whole year there'll be certain holidays that cannot fall on certain days, because they're going to be X number of days from Rosh Hashanah. So if Rosh Hashanah cannot be on a certain day, then certain holidays. Pesach, the first night of Pesach, cannot be Sunday night, Wednesday night, or Friday night. I'm sorry, Thursday night. But that's not a separate rule. That's only a corollary of Rosh Hashanah. Once Rosh Hashanah cannot be certain times, that'll have a ripple effect on Pesach. So among them, among the ripple effects is, Asara B'Teves can never be on Shabbos. Because you can't get it. If Rosh Hashanah can only fall on those other days, Asara B'Teves can never be on Shabbos. And however, the Avud Rav says, theoretically, if it would be on Shabbos, we would actually fast on Asara B'Teves. That's how important the fast is. So although it's a short fast, in fact, it is the shortest fast of the year, because it only begins in the morning, and it's a shorter day than the summer fasts or the like, but it's a very, very important fast at the same time. Well, it doesn't end at sunset. It ends when the stars come out. So that's like a half an hour after sunset. Yeah. But it does not begin the night before. It begins at dawn. So theoretically, if you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you could eat something. So it depends if you.
Do you think it's worthwhile?
No, it actually probably is not. But it depends. I mean, some people need the sleep more than the food. So it all depends on what's more important for you. Okay. All right, so we basically, I think, finished. I think the unit that we were talking about was the treatment of the terminally ill and how you deal with people at the end of life and those medical ethics issues. And that was part of a broader unit. We talked about organ donation and we talked about stem cell research and all of that. So today I'm going to start a new, totally new topic, but we did touch upon it incidentally in a lot of our discussions, and I want to discuss some issues about marriage and divorce. Okay, I feel bad bringing up divorce, God forbid, but just as an intellectual endeavor, it should have no practical relevance to any of you at all. Jewish marriage, let's talk a little bit about Jewish marriage. Again, I'm not going to talk about all the spiritual ideals in it, although I will mention one little thought, and that is...
Can I leave my phone?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Can I leave my phone?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yep.
This is important stuff. This is really important stuff.
You know, when Hashem created Chava, right? Adam was created by himself. Now there is a machlokas. What was Adam's status before Chava? There are two opinions in the Gemara. Was it just man, and then Hashem made woman, or was Adam a kind of hybrid, a joint, a bisexual hermaphrodite. Creature, hermaphrodite, that's right. But with two heads, back to back, strangely enough.
I heard that.
Yeah. And then Hashem separated. And that's a machlokas in the Gemara. That's a machlokas. Was there man and woman as one, and then Hashem separated? Or was there first man, and then Hashem made woman? But be it as it may, the reason why Hashem either made woman or Hashem separated them was because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said a very important idea. Lo tov peyos ha'adam levado. It is not good for man to be alone. Eselo ezer Let me make a helpmate, kenegdo, to be opposite him. So the critical point is, it is not good for the human to be in a state of aloneness. So the commentaries raise the obvious question, what's so bad being alone? Remember, Adam is in the Garden of Eden. He doesn't really need anybody to do anything for him. He can eat anything he wants except for that one tree, you know, that's the one thing he can't eat. He doesn't need clothes or laundry because he's going, you know, naked. So what is so bad being alone if you're in the Garden of Eden? So the commentaries say a very, very beautiful thought, a very, very powerful thought. They say that man in a state of aloneness has an infinite capacity to take from the world whatever he wants. But he has no one to whom to give. And since our essence is our godly soul, and our soul is godly to the extent it emulates the ways of God, and God is only a giver, not a taker, because there is nothing you can give to God, because God owns everything. So I can become a godly person, and my godly soul can achieve its potential only when it becomes a giver and not a taker. And therefore, when it says lo tov, it is not good for man to be alone, we can translate it slightly differently. Man cannot be in a state of goodness when he is alone, because goodness is the ultimate attribute of Hashem. Hashem is the ultimate goodness. And therefore, goodness is giving, not taking. And therefore, Hashem created marriage, the interaction of man and woman, to give us the opportunity, man and woman, to become godly by learning to selflessly give to the other. That's an amazing thought. So just if you remember, well, this is before you were born, but I'm sure you have heard of the Lahavdil, the famous inaugural address of John F. Kennedy. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So in marriage, it's exactly the same thing. Ask not what your marriage can do for you. Ask what you can do for your marriage. Meaning, because marriage is to teach me to be a giver and not a taker. Because that makes me godly. That makes me tov. Now, it's very complicated, because one thing you need to understand, part of being a giver is to learn how to take as well. This is a very, very important idea. Because let's say you have a situation, this is more of a problem that men have, I think, maybe more than women. In other words, a man's male ego often says he wants to be the one that gives. But when you all you do is give and you refuse to take from the other person, you're making that person feel like a shmata. That person feels like a beggar. That person feels they're not contributing anything to your life. So this is a very interesting subtlety, that in the avoda of being a nosei, being a giver, one also has to be a makabel, because by accepting, you are giving that person dignity, respect, showing that they matter to you, that they're not just a recipient of your goodness and the like. So that's an important point to keep in mind, that giving does involve the ability to take and receive as well.
When it says it's not just man to be alone, well, it's not really speaking about women, though. And women also don't have them sitting in marriage.
Yes, that's correct. But again, I would suggest it this way. I would suggest it, again, this gets us into generalizations, which I know people don't always like. And that is that the Zohar says, this is going with the opinion that first there was man, then there was woman, as opposed to both. Zohar says that men need the tikkun of marital relationship because their essential sense of identity was aloneness. They came into the world without a mate. And therefore, for a man's definition of self is kind of a self-contained selfishness, which therefore needs to be transcended by marital union. A woman came into the world in the context of community. In other words, there was an Adam before there was a Chava. There was never a Chava without an Adam. And as a result, women are definitionally more attuned to relationship and community and friendship, and therefore they need less of the tikkun. In fact, it's a funny thing. On one hand, you could say a woman has less of a mitzvah to get married because she'll want to get married anyway. You know, that's exactly the point. You know, there was a famous social psychologist, Carol Gilligan. She was a professor at Harvard University. And she wrote, not Jewish, obviously, so she wasn't writing to prove any Jewish point. But this was during the years of feminism. Gloria Steinem, 1970s, the height of the first feminist movement. And many feminists were saying that there are no real differences between men and women. All of this is environmental, all of this is social, men and women are really the same, there's no differences. So she did research to show that even from the earliest ages, boys and girls look at the world in different ways. Now, of course, if you want to be critical, you could say, okay, that just means they were socialized from three, but whatever. But she went back a long way. And let me give you some examples of what she did. She administered Carol Gilligan. A Catholic woman. She's not, again, not Jewish at all. This was the experiment she administered. She gave a test to a bunch of six-year-olds, boys and girls. And this was the test. You have a child, and the child is very sick, and the child needs medicine. And the only medicine that's available right now, it's late at night, is this drugstore that's not 24 hours, that's closed for the night. And if you have to wait until the morning, then God forbid, you know, something bad might happen. So what do you do when you have to get the medicine? So every boy said, you take a rock,
oh my God,
you break the window, and you take the medicine. Now, on one level, that's a perfectly valid answer. Pikuach nefesh, to save a life, you do what you have to do. Every girl also said, you know, you break the rock if you have to, but they said, but be sure to leave a note. And call the police ahead of time so they'll know what you're doing. Now, she was trying to say the following. She was trying to say that the male modality of thinking tends to be very, very intense and focused on the critical point, meaning you identify what is the most important aspect, and you focus on it, but you ignore everything else. You ignore the other relationships that are impacted. You ignore the impact of the glass on the street, or the rights of the store owner, etc. You just focus on the most important thing. Women were more attuned to the notion that there are other relationships here, meaning you also have. In other words, yes, there is the most important thing, but you also have to consider the other things. So the idea basically is, in Judaism, you often find this idea that those neshamos that need certain rectifications are given certain commandments, and those neshamos that don't need those rectifications are not given those commandments because they're not needed. So this is the idea that marriage is to teach us how to be givers rather than takers. In fact, it's very interesting. You know, the Hebrew word for the Dead Sea is Yam HaMelech, the Salt Sea. But so normally we don't make drushes based on the English name, but I'm going to give you a drush based on the English name. That why is the Dead Sea called the Dead Sea? So the simple meaning, there's a simple shot. Obviously it's called the Dead Sea because the mineral content is so high that there are no fish that can live in the Dead Sea. But some want to give a drush because the Dead Sea receives water. Everything goes in, but nothing goes out. When you just take from the world and you don't give, you're spiritually dead. You're spiritually alive only when you give and not when you take. And therefore the Dead Sea is considered to be dead because you take and you don't give. Now, one other point in that pasuk, Hashem then said, let me make a helpmate to be opposite him. Opposite him. So the Gemara already asked the Kasha, that's a contradiction. Helpmate or opposition? Technically, it's a contradiction. Is my spouse supposed to help me? Or is my spouse supposed to oppose me? And why would that be? So the Talmud itself, the Gemara itself, gives a pragmatic answer. It says, it depends. Some people get one type, some people get another type. Meaning, if you merit, you get Ezer. If you don't merit, you get Kenegda. But in the Hasidic Svarim, they give a different thought. And again, it's an important idea. That sometimes the real help that husbands and wives give to each other is the fact that they see the world in different ways. that there is an opposition. Now, this is a loving and loyal opposition, meaning to say the following. If, on some level, everybody has a Yetzer Hara that they would love to marry a clone of themselves, although you can't really have a same-sex clone. Somebody who thinks exactly like me, who agrees with me 100% of the time, who every decision I make, the other person always says is right. And that's kind of a good feeling. You know, there's even a wind-up toy you can get in an airport for beleaguered middle management executives. This is a little doll that you wind up, and the doll says, "You're right, you're smart, you're better than all the people in the office, you know, they don't know what they're talking about," you know, and it's kind of, you know, it's unfortunate sometimes sometimes we have to get that encouragement, you know, from a wind-up toy. Now, in a marriage, that is important. I mean, it is important that husband and wife support each other and give each other chizuk, you know, whether it's the husband or the wife. You know, we go out in the world, and people might embarrass us, might humiliate us. We have setbacks and failures. It is important to have an environment at home in which each one strengthens the other. But if a relationship is really deep, people grow by the fact that each one brings different ways of looking at the world. And therefore, I grow because I can see the world through my wife's eyes. My wife grows. She can see the world through my eyes. Each of us reach a state of wholeness that is greater than the sum of the individual parts. So Ezer Kenegdo is not a contradiction. The real help is the Kenegdo, is the opposite perspectives. Men and women are different in that way. In fact, although there are many men without getting into same-sex marriage, one might say, this is maybe only one of a million ideas, but one idea is that, hey, same-sex marriage can't work because it is precisely the male-female in which the world is seen in different ways that creates a shlemus. If it's male-male or female-female, you're not going to necessarily have that diversity of view which creates a shlemus and life. But again, that's hardly the final reason. There are many other problems as well. So I'll give you an example from the Gemara about this. Nothing to do with marriage, but one can draw an analogy. You've heard, I'm sure, if you studied Gemara, I'm sure you've come across the great rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan, one of the great rabbis of the Talmud. And Rabbi Yochanan had a student who was kind of a colleague of his, and this was also his brother-in-law, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, sometimes called Resh. Resh is an abbreviation of Resh Lakish. Do you know the story of Resh Lakish? This is a very, very fascinating story. Yeah. Resh Lakish had an earlier career. Resh Lakish was a Baal Tshuva. Resh Lakish was a robber, a bandit. And he would attack people. Maybe he even killed them, I don't know, but he would rob them. And he once attacked Rabbi Yochanan, and he robbed Rabbi Yochanan. And Rabbi Yochanan apparently was very, very beautiful. Now, he didn't think Rabbi Yochanan was a girl, but basically Rabbi Yochanan said to Resh Lakish, "A man like you should devote yourself to Torah." So Resh Lakish said to him, "A man like you should devote yourself to prostitution because you're so pretty." That's what he said. Kind of, you see the way he was. You see the way he was speaking to a great rabbi like this. So Rav Yochanan said, "Ah, if you only met my sister, she's so much more beautiful." So he induced through this. He bribed Resh Lakish. Basically, he told Resh Lakish. Of course, these stories, the sister somehow never consulted. You know, it's interesting. But he basically said, "You sit and learn Torah. You become religious. You keep the mitzvos. You get to marry my sister." So Resh Lakish accepted this, and he became a very, very great Talmud Chacham. And throughout Shas, throughout the Talmud, often he will argue with Rav Yochanan. They argue with each other. He was great enough that eventually he could actually argue with Rav Yochanan. But it says, every time Rav Yochanan would give a shir, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish would ask him 24 kashas, 24 questions that Rav Yochanan had to answer, or concede that he couldn't answer. Resh Lakish died tragically, and of course Rav Yochanan was heartbroken. And number one, it was his sister's husband, and number two, it was his beloved disciple. And another man took Resh Lakish's place. Another great rabbi kind of took the firing line seat. And every time Rav Yochanan said something, this other rabbi would bring 24 proofs that Rav Yochanan was right. He was a real yes man, but he actually showed Rav Yochanan is right. And Rav Yochanan started crying and sobbing. And he said, "Where is Reish Lakish? Where is Reish Lakish? I miss Reish Lakish." So his students said to him, "What do you mean, Reish Lakish? Every time you said something, Reish Lakish would bother you for an hour trying to cut you down. And here you have a person, every time you say something, he proves that you're right." So Rav Yochanan said, "I didn't need someone to prove that I'm right. If I didn't think I was right, I wouldn't say it. But Reish Lakish challenged me. He made me think about my position. He forced me to explain things if I needed to explain them, or to develop it in a deeper way, or if I was wrong, to, you know, change my position. That is what I needed. That is a Talmud that makes the Rebbe wise, right? The Rebbe gets wise as well from the what the Talmidim say. So the Mefarshim say that marriage works in kind of a similar model. That's the Ezer Kenegdo. I don't mean one is Rebbe, one is a Talmud. I'm not making that analogy. I'm just simply saying that it's the challenge that each one sees the world in a different way. That is what the Avos, Sora saw things that Avram didn't see. Avram was so kind, and Avram was the Midah of Chesed. So here you have this Yishmael that is ruining everything. And Avram doesn't have the ability to send Yishmael away. But Sarah was able to know that that was the right thing to do. With Yitzchak and Rivka, that got replicated in a more subtle way, in which Yitzchak wanted to bless Esav, and it was Rivka that saw the truth, etc. So this is the idea of Ezer Kenegdo, interaction and partnership and loving connection does not mean sameness, but rather it's precisely through the different perspectives that each person brings that one achieves a shlemus. So the Ezer Kenegdo is a very, very important idea. And once again, the male ego in particular needs that interaction, because it is the nature of man to be self-sufficient, to have the illusion of control. And therefore Hashem basically says we need to interact and the like. This is what they say. People debate always who are better, men or women. I don't want to get into that, because it just turns into either anti-women or anti-men. So it's, in a way, you don't get anywhere. Meaning some people say, men are better because of this, and women say women are better. So some people say, well, by definition, women must be higher, because in the hierarchy of creation, the lower precedes the higher. Right, you start your meaning to say, on Friday, man was created, and woman was created after man. So, if woman was created after man, doesn't that mean women are higher? But some say, well, not really, because the last thing God did was patch up the man. So in a sense, he completed the man after. Okay, so the issue is not to discuss higher or lower. The issue is different. That is, men and women are different, and they are both needed. The whole idea of the spheros, I don't know how much, when you learn Tanya, if you got into the Kabbalistic parts of the Tanya, I'm not sure. Yeah, so if you understand, the Hashem Shefa, the divine influence that comes through the spheros, starts off with the unification of Chachma and Bina. That Chachma and Bina unite in what's called Das, Chabad, Chachma Bina Das, and then they produce all of the different emotional attributes of Chesed and Gevura. Now, this is an explicitly sexual metaphor. Chachma Bina. Chachma is said to be the male factor, the initial flash, like the male seed. Bina is the development, like a woman developing, right? So it's Chachma and Bina that produces the Shefa, which means the Shekhinah involves the combination of masculine and feminine elements. And therefore, a marriage is really a replication of the cosmic unification of God above, bringing bracha into the world. Okay, so this is, don't report me, I'm not supposed to, I'm only supposed to talk about halacha, but okay, just to give you a little bit of introductory remarks to our halachic discussion of marriage. Now, I'm going to tell you something a little bit. Again, my main goal in this unit is really to talk about divorce, but I guess it would be helpful before we talk about divorce to talk a little bit about marriage itself, and again, I said hopefully that will be the more relevant to you all, and that is the Jewish marriage ceremony actually comprises two separate ceremonies that used to be separated by 12 months. Two different ceremonies that are now combined the same night. But they used to be a year apart. So let me first describe the original way the ceremony was conducted, and then how did it get changed, and when did it get changed, and why did it get changed. In the Torah, marriage occurs in two stages. Stage one is called Erusin or Kiddushin. Now, it's important that you keep in mind that modern Hebrew is very confusing here. In modern Hebrew, Erusin means engagement, and it's not marriage at all. So if somebody says to you they're inviting you to their Erusin, that would be like saying they're inviting you to their vort or to their l'chaim or whatever term you want to use. Okay? But that's not what the term means in the Torah, and it's not what the term means in the Gemara. The term in the Torah doesn't talk about engagement at all. The term in Chazal for engagement is called shiduchim. So that we're not going to talk about so much. But Erusin is bona fide marriage. Erusin is when a man gives a woman something worth a minimal amount of money. It could be a ring, that's what it is today, but it doesn't have to be a ring. It could actually be a coin. You could marry a woman with a shekel. No, not you, but a man can marry a woman with a shekel. He gives the coin or the shekel or the property or the cup or the book. It has to be something he owns. And he says to the woman in front of witnesses, Hare at mekudeshet li, behold, you are sanctified to me, b'tabas zu, with this ring, kedas Moshe v'Yisrael, in accordance with the laws of Moses and Israel. She has to accept. If she doesn't accept, she's not married, meaning marriage has to be with her consent, of course. And once she accepts the ring in front of the witnesses, even if she doesn't put it on her finger, or she accepts the coin, could be anything, and anything of money, she is now an Eshes Ish. And that is called Erusin, or Kiddushin, and it's sometimes translated as betrothal, but it's not engagement, it is actual marriage. If she would commit adultery at that point, that would be a capital crime. Now, that's all there was, because basically, for the next year, she actually lived with her parents still. And the marriage was not consummated for a whole year, meaning she was an Arusa, but there was no consummation of the marriage.
What's the reason for that?
Well, it's a little unclear. It seems to have been primarily an economic reason, that once a woman was married, she was expected, or her parents were expected, to raise a dowry with money and property, so they were given a year to kind of prepare what was necessary. It wasn't mandatory to have a year, but a year was the maximum, and a year was apparently the customary amount. Now, after the year, we now have stage two of the marriage. Stage two of the marriage is called Nisuin, which is actually the modern Hebrew term for marriage. Nisuin. What did Nisuin involve? Number one, Nisuin involved the recitation of seven blessings, the Sheva Brachos, and it involved the Chasan taking the Kala into his home, meaning bringing her into the home, and eventually, shortly thereafter, consummating the marriage physically. So, and once the woman is named Nisuah, she is now a fully married woman. So, halachically, there are a number of differences. For that year, she's an Eishes Ish. She is a married woman. She was called an Arusa, but she did not become a Nesua till the Chasan brought her into his home and the marriage was consummated, and that typically took place after a year. What are some of the differences between the status of an Arusa and the status of a Nesua? A number of things. A lot of them are economic. If, God forbid, a woman dies, her husband inherits her property. But that's only after Nisuin. If she dies as an Arusa, before she consummated the marriage, the property would go to her parents. It would not go to her husband, right? So inheritance rights are affected. Also, there are rules regarding, some of these might be arcane, there are rules regarding nullification of vows. A husband can nullify the vows of his wife, but that's only after Nisuin. If it's Erusin, you need a partnership of husband and father, meaning a husband cannot do it alone. Okay? Now, when did the Kesuvah kick in? Only for Nisuin. There was no Kesuvah for Erusin. And of course, let me also mention the obligation of support. The husband has a halachic obligation to support his wife, but that halachic obligation kicks in only after Nisuin. During Erusin, she is either on her own or her parents support her. The husband does not have an obligation to support his wife, that is, an Arusa. Now, again, this is very odd. This is very, very different than what we're used to. This suggests that a woman was actually a married woman for a whole year before there was consummation. And we don't do this today at all. We may have an engagement, but we certainly don't have an actual marriage. So when did we collapse it into one big ceremony? It's fairly late. It's after the time of the Mishnah, after the time of the Gemara. It takes us all the way to Rashi. In fact, some people credit Rashi as enacting that we unify the ceremonies of Erusin and Nisuin, and that's why we do everything the same day.
So when was the Ketubah?
Well, the Ketubah is already in the Gemara, but the Ketubah was Nisuin, not Erusin. Only when the second one. So now, let me take you through a typical Jewish wedding, and then we'll try to identify which belong to part one and which belong to part two. I think you'll be a little surprised, because what we think of as the end of part one is actually the beginning of part two. Okay. You show up at a Jewish wedding. Now, some of the stuff is just extra stuff that's not necessary. They think Kabbalah's Panim, you know, the pre-marriage Kiddush. All right.
Doesn't he have to see her before the wedding?
Okay, so here, you have to differentiate between absolute halacha and custom. Over the many, many years, there are many, many, many minhagim about a chasan and a kala. Some of the minhagim are so old that they become laws, they become dinim, but they're certainly not required either to oraisa or to rabbanan, but they become very beloved customs that one should keep. Among these customs are that the chasan and the kala fast on the day of their marriage because it's like Yom Kippur, but it is a custom, and that's why if it's very hard, you know, there's a lot of leniency. Another custom is they don't see each other for a week before the wedding. Again, that is a custom. It is not a law. And if they absolutely have to see each other for whatever reason, they are permitted to do so. But part of it is, you know, you see each other, people are nervous, people are tense, there might be fighting. You know, we don't want them to enter the marriage in a state of machlok. Right? Those are our customs. The idea that when you show up, there's, you know, a chassan's tish and a kala's tish. You know, you don't have to have that. If somebody would be poor, you know, you don't have to make a wedding that way. But these are conventions, okay? So what I want you to see, I want you to be able to strip away in your mind's eye the very beautiful minhagim, but separate them from the core of what halacha says you must do.
I was curious because I spoke to a woman who's told us Aaron.
Yes.
She said that she met her husband after the chuppah.
What?
Like after they already got married, then they like met.
Oh, they didn't even meet before the marriage?
That
appears not to be halakhically correct. Now it is
maybe they like saw each other's faces.
Well, in fact, that's one of the reasons for the bedekin. Now it is true. It is true. Among many chassidim, and even non-chassidim, shiduchim marriages were arranged blindly, without the chassan even seeing the kala or vice versa. But before the kedushin, before the erusin, he has to see. In fact, one of the reasons for the looking at the kala and then covering is that he should see. Should both see who they're marrying.
Is halachically, you do have to see him.
Yes. But even if it's only 1 minute before the chuppah, but they have to see each other 1 minute before the.
Does the halacha say they actually have to meet before the wedding?
Say what? Say again.
Does the halacha that they actually have to
like, say it was like a blind veteran.
Yeah, they have to see. They have to see each other before the wedding, even if it's once. That is a halacha.
They don't have to speak.
They don't have to speak, but they have to see. They have to see each other. They have to see each other. Right. As I say, even among most Hasidim, they tend not to be that strict. Toldos Aron is a very, very strict group. But even though among Hasidim, they certainly don't have like long courtship periods. Basically, the shidduch is prearranged. They'll meet in some parent's house for a half an hour, you know, and maybe that'll be it. You know, that is relatively common, and the like. I mean, the argument goes that hey, you know, your parents know what's better for you than you do. You know, so, I mean, it's a different mindset. It may not work for many of us, but Baruch Hashem. I mean, Baruch Hashem, it can produce good marriages as well. Okay, so once. So the first thing we have is, the first real ceremony we have is called the Badekin. The Badekin is when the Chassan goes into the Kala's room and covers her with a veil. Now, the Badekin serves a double function. Number one, it ensures that they see each other before the chuppah, which is a halachic requirement. Number two, it is a reminder of the importance of modesty and snias in the marriage. And covering is, in other words, that not to be available for other people. Just as Rivka, when Rivka saw Yitzchak, she covered her face. And the third, she fell herself. Yeah. And the third idea is that this is the beginning of the. It's the beginning of the Nisuan process of bringing her home, so to speak. But technically, it's pre-chuppah, so it doesn't count. Okay, but now, the marriage ceremony itself. So what part is the ersin? The ersin is when the chassan gives the kala the ring in front of two witnesses and says, Harei at mikudeshes li, right? Behold, you are married to me, betrothed to me, sanctified to me, in accordance with the laws of Moshe and Yisrael. And when the ring is put on her finger, she is now an arusa. In the time of the Gemara, the wedding would have ended there. They would have had a meal, but it would have ended there. It would have ended there. No Sheva Brachos, no Kesuvah. It would have ended right there. And even the meal that they would have would not have had Sheva Brachas, because Sheva Brachas is connected to the Nisuin ceremony, not the Ersin ceremony. So here's where people get confused, because right after the ring ceremony, the Ksuva is read and Sheva Brachas are recited, but that's not the end of part one. That's the beginning of part two. Part one ended with the ring ceremony. The Ksuva is the beginning of part two. And here is how it works. She is now an arusa, but we are now going to begin the Nisuin ceremony.
The man doesn't have a halakhic status then?
Well, yeah, the man is called an arus. Arus is the male, and arusa is the female. Right, so they are husband and wife. Now, as you know, it is essential that this be witnessed by two witnesses. See, this is very different than the Goyim. A rabbi does not marry a couple. So we talk about a priest marrying a couple. A rabbi does not marry a couple. The couple marries themselves. The rabbi is there to supervise that they are following the proper steps. And if there's no rabbi there, I mean, you know, this happens, you know, sometimes when kids, you know, in day schools learn about Kedushin, that all you have to do is give a woman money and say Harei Mekudeshesli, and if she accepts it. So sometimes in co-educational day schools, you have these like sixth graders who like to fool around. Maybe not sixth, they're at bar mitzvah yet, but let's say seventh graders, they're bar mitzvah. So they'll walk by a girl and you know, throw her a quarter and say, Harei Mekudeshesli, with the Mazel Gass Mashiach Yisrael, right? Well, it's not always a joke, you know. Does a woman need a get? Does she have to cover her hair? You know, in seventh grade and the like. So you don't need a rabbi. You don't need a rabbi. You're supposed to have a rabbi, but you don't need a rabbi. The only thing you need, huh? You need witnesses. That's the important thing. Oh, so that's the thing. The one indispensable thing that you need to make a kosher marriage is you need two witnesses who witness the giving of that ring. If you don't have two witnesses, the marriage is not valid, even if both the husband and the wife admit that they did it. It's not valid. Now, the two witnesses have many halachos that they have to have. They do have to be men. They do have to be above bar mitzvah. They have to be Jewish, of course. They cannot be related to the chasan or the kala, and they cannot be related to each other. And most importantly, they have to be Shabbos observant. They have to be Orthodox. If they are not Shabbos observant, they are not halachically kosher witnesses, and as a result, the marriage is not valid. Now, in some cases, that's actually a blessing in disguise, because we'll see later, when you have problems, God forbid later, where a husband doesn't want to give his wife a get, we sometimes are able to determine there were not kosher witnesses because they weren't observant and the like, and that actually frees the woman of the responsibility of getting a get because there were not kosher witnesses. Now, this raises some very crazy things, because there are rabbis in Israel that say that any Jew that owns a smartphone is not an observant Jew and is not a kosher witness. There are some rabbis that say that. So that's a very interesting phenomenon, because in the United States, I would think most rabbis, not at least non-Hasidic rabbis, I don't have a smartphone, although not so much out of religious principle, but I haven't gotten around to it. But there are rabbis in Israel who take this very seriously, and they actually say a couple is not married if one of the witnesses owns a smartphone or whatever it is.
Well, doesn't mean at the time of the marriage.
Of the marriage, yeah.
Or can they have the smartphone later and still be considered as kosher witnesses at the time of witnessing?
Well, I don't mean to say they have to have it in their pocket. Meaning, if they owned a smartphone.
Right. No, but if they owned it later. They just bought the smartphone.
No. Well, all right, so it depends. Do we say he always had it in him? Yeah. I mean, basically, I mean, as a general rule, if somebody was a kosher witness and then committed sins later, that doesn't make them no good all the way back. On the other hand, if at the time he already had the nefarious evil thought that he was going to get a smartphone, then that may puzzle him, you know. So, now again, I think it's extreme, and I think Lemaisa, if that would be the case, a lot of Jewish marriages would be null and void. But certainly, I think it's absolutely clear that if you're talking about Chilul Shabbos, not a kosher witness. Did you want to say something? Yeah, you had your hand up.
No, you answered my question.
Okay.
Just wanted to know if they didn't keep Shabbat, then the marriage is not...
The marriage is not a valid marriage.
If
that's
any
correct.
Jewish marriage, like a secular marriage...
Okay, all right, so let's go to that. So according to that view, that is really why we often say marriages in the Reform movement or in the conservative movement or a civil marriage would not be... This is Reb Moshe Feinstein's view. It was not halachically valid, not because it wasn't in an Orthodox synagogue. That's not relevant, but simply because, and not even because a Reform rabbi was there. But the problem is, if you didn't have the kosher witnesses, you have a problem. You see? Now, there's another rule in halacha that's very tricky, and some people are strict on this. That you have to designate who you want the witnesses to be, because if you don't, everybody who sees it becomes a witness. So let's say you have 100 people who see it, and one of them is not Shabbos observant, the marriage may be puzzle.
Really?
So the way, and that's why if you listen carefully when you go to a wedding, you'll notice sometimes that the rabbi will tell the chasan or the kala, these are the two witnesses you're designating to the exclusion of everybody else. Have you ever heard that announcement?
Yeah.
Because the concept is, unless you exclude the other people, then anybody in the audience who can see may make it puzzle if they're not Shomer Shabbos. So that's why you have to have two witnesses who are, you know, Shomer Shabbos to the exclusion of everybody else. Okay? That's the idea. You'll also notice, if you listen, a lot of times, you know, you don't hear the chuppah because it's, you know, it's noisy or whatever, there's no microphone. But the rabbi will take the ring before the chassan gives it to the kala. He will show it to the witnesses, and he will say, in your judgment, is this ring worth at least a penny? Because it has to be a penny's worth, a pruta's worth. And the witnesses hopefully will say, yes, yes, it's worth a penny. They have to say that. And in addition, the rabbi will ask the chassan, is this your ring? That's very important, by the way. A man cannot marry a woman with borrowed property. Now, let's say, I mean, imagine the scenario. Imagine this is a kind of a hapless chassan. The chassan shows up and he lost the ring or forgot the ring. So he says to his friend, you know, let's say his friend wears a ring, says, can you just give me that ring? Let me borrow the ring, Judge, for the ceremony. The halacha is that marriage is valid only if the chassan owns the ring that he gives to the kala. If he doesn't own it, it's not a valid marriage. And there's sometimes a shaila, if he still owes money on the ring, is he the owner? Meaning, if he bought the jewelry on credit and he owes money on it, there is some question. So one of the questions the rabbi will ask is this ring paid up? Because if it's not paid up, there is some question whether the chassan owns it. You see? Okay. So that's the end of part one. So part one ends. You're still under the chuppah. And you're going to do more stuff under the chuppah. But that's part two already. Part one ends with the ring, the giving of the ring. Harei at mekudeshet li. The rabbi asked the questions beforehand. Now then you'll notice, that is why in Yerushalayim there's a minhag that's a little different than you'll see in America. We know that one of the customs, which has become a halacha because it's a custom, is we break a glass at a Jewish marriage. That's a custom. It's become a halacha because it's a custom. It's already recorded in the Gemara. Yeah, it's a rabbinic custom. And the reason was that in the moment of this great, great joy and simcha, we remember the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the gullus of the Jewish people. And we recite, or we sing, some recite it, some say it, and some sing it, Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, the famous verse from Tehillim, if I forget you, Yerushalayim, Tishkach Yemini, may I forget my right hand, Tidbak Lashoni Lechiki, may my tongue cleave to my palate, Imlo Eskerechi, if I don't remember you, Imlo Allah Es Yerushalayim, Al Rosh Simchasi, if I don't put Jerusalem above my greatest joys. It's a very, very moving moment. And then the chassan smashes the glass. Now, if people say, it's a little in Congress, people start screaming, Mazel Tov. You know, again, now some rabbanim say, this should be a moment of reflection. But I just want to point out, in America, you will notice, again, I don't know how many weddings you've been at, so I don't know if you're able to notice all these things. In America, they tend to break the glass after the Sheva Brachos. In Eretz Yisrael, they break the glass right after the ring ceremony. You'll notice they break the glass before they do the ksuba, before they break it right away, which in a sense actually makes sense because that's the end of the marriage ceremony. The next is Nisuin. Okay? In fact, that explains why you have two different cups of wine. I forgot to say, before the ring ceremony, a cup of wine is filled up, and the rabbi who's conducting the ceremony says blessings on the wine, and then the chassan and the kala drinks, and then there's the ring ceremony. Now, when we're going to recite seven blessings under the chuppah, we fill up another cup of wine. Why do I need another cup of wine? Why can't I use the remainder of the cup of wine and just add more wine? The answer is, because originally these were two different ceremonies that were a year apart. So even when they got combined, we commemorate them by two separate Borei Pri Hagafen. We make two blessings. You see? So that itself shows you we're dealing with a part two and a part one. They were originally not the same. They were originally separated by a whole year. So even when we combine them, we still have two cups of wine and two different Borei Pri Hagafens. Yeah, question.
You said Sheva Brachos
to
be at the end of 7 days.
No. That's also a little confusing. I am referring to seven blessings under the chuppah itself.
Oh.
The seven. The 7 days of celebration is another thing. I'm talking about under the chuppah. There are seven blessings under the chuppah itself. So what is part two of the ceremony, which used to be a year apart? So part two is that a document is prepared that is called the kesuvah. Now, what is the kesuvah? Jewish marriage must have a kesuvah. Now, let me clarify something, because a lot of people, again, get this wrong as well. A marriage is valid even if there's no kesuvah. Kesuvah is not necessary for the validity of a marriage. Even if there's no kesuvah, for one reason it wasn't done, it's still a valid kosher marriage, but it's not a permissible marriage, meaning, yeah, we're married, but we're not allowed to live together until we do a kesuvah. So you have to do a kesuvah, but it's not a condition for the validity of the marriage. Now, the kesuvah itself is written in Aramaic. Not only is it hard to translate, it's even hard to read sometimes. If a rabbi is not familiar with it, the rabbi might stumble over the words of the kesuvah itself. It's in Aramaic. But essentially, the kesuvah reiterates the obligations of a husband, it's mainly a husband's obligations, to support his wife, to honor his wife, to cherish his wife. So it's a pretty good document for you, that the husband must support. And in addition, now this may not be so great today, in the event of the death of the husband or the divorce, death or divorce, the husband agrees, or the husband's estate agrees, to pay the wife certain money in order to help her. It is a prenuptial agreement, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now the problem is the actual amounts of the kesuvah are relatively small. They're not huge amounts. The amount of the kesuvah is said to be, it's expressed in ancient coinage, that's the problem, 200 zuz. Remember, a goat was bought for 2 zuzim. That's chad gadya, right? My father bought a goat for 2 zuzim. This is 200 zuzim. I'll try to tell you what that equals. 200 zuzim.
That's not like a prenup. A prenup is when you say, if we get divorced, I'm not giving you anything.
I'm not.
No. No. A prenup. A prenup can be anything. A prenup just means. An agreement before marriage. So 200 zuz, and by the way, if the woman was married before, it's only 100 zuz, so it may even be half of that. 200 zuz, a zuz is an ancient coin. So it's kind of crazy, the kesuvah is expressed in terms of an ancient currency. But basically, a zuz, 200 zuz is, depending on the price of silver, is around $20,000. It doesn't translate into a huge amount of money. Now, here, there is a difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim in Israel. Ashkenazim go with the Talmudic text of the Ksuba that was 200 zuz. Now, in Talmudic times, 200 zuz was enough money to support a woman for 1 year. It was something. Today, it's not really enough. So Sephardim, they don't put in the 200 zuz. They put in, negotiated amounts. They'll put in 1,000,000 shkalim or 100,000 shkalim or 200,000 shkalim. So Sephardic kesuvahs, just as a matter of their own custom, are more tailor-made and individualized than Ashkenazic kesuvahs, which tend to just go with the ancient amounts. But let me point out here halachically that you need to know there's a big, big difference between the rights of a divorced woman and the rights of a widow. The kesuvah rights are very, very different. And let me explain how this works. If, God forbid, a woman is a widow, here is her rights. She has the right to remain in the dira that she shared with her husband, even if it's not in her name. And she can remain rent-free until she remarries and the like. And the yorshim, whether it's her sons or her stepchildren, they have to pay the rent, they have to pay the mortgage, they have to pay the utilities. And she has the right to be supported in the manner that she was supported in her husband's lifetime by the estate of the husband. And both of those rights exist until she decides to remarry. when she decides to remarry, she can then get kicked out of that house, and they don't have to support her, and that's when she collects her kesuvah of the 200 zuz, meaning a widow will not collect her kesuvah until she wants to get remarried, because that this way she has much more benefits. Okay, do you understand the way it works? In other words, a widow gets supported from her husband's estate by her children or stepchildren, and she occupies the dira that she shared with her husband rent-free until she remarries.
What if the estate is not able to support her? There's some kind of financial crisis.
Yeah, yeah. So then she's in trouble. Meaning, it's not a personal obligation. It's not a personal obligation of the children. Now, of course, as a matter of chesed, they should do it, decency. But technically, these rights are not rights on the children. These are rights against the husband's estate. So that's important. So it's only if there's enough in the husband's estate will she have those rights. At the point that she decides to get married, that is when she collects her kesuvah and she's no longer entitled. Now, if she's divorced, on the other hand, life is not so good for her. If she is divorced, she doesn't have the right to live in the family home, nor does she have the right to be supported. Her only right is the kesuvah. So she might as well collect her kesuvah as soon as possible. Yes, yes. Now, the only thing is, let me point out, that in modern times, most of the time, in most marriages, an apartment is in both names, the husband's and the wife's names. This is a very important subtlety. The Gemara's rule that she can get kicked out of the family home when she's divorced is when it is not in her name. If she is a co-owner, then obviously she will be entitled to 50% of that dira. In other words, you have to be very careful. In the time of the Gemara, it was not common for women to be co-owners of property with their husbands. So the Gemara's case, right, this is very important, when people apply the Gemara without understanding that the factual realities are different, they're going to make mistakes. So the Gemara is presupposing where all of the property is in the husband's name, so the wife, a divorced woman, has no right to live in the family home. If she's a co-owner, she certainly does have that right, meaning to say, well, they could demand a sale, but obviously she's going to get 50% of the value of that apartment.
Like if the guy flew off with some bird, okay, yep. And like, you know, and she's not on the contract, it's not her fault that the marriage collapsed.
No, I understand, but, well, you know, it is an unfair thing, for sure. But the point basically is, given the fact that the husband has the right to divorce her, then you know he has no further obligation after divorce. Now, there is an interesting Gemara though. The Gemara gives the story of Rav Yossi, and Rav Yossi had a very, very difficult wife, and they got divorced because she wanted to marry a rich guy. She basically said, "Oh, you're a bum. All you do is learn all the time. You know, I want to marry somebody that will give me a good life." So she marries some rich guy, and this rich guy loses his entire fortune. And he's bankrupt, and she's in the street. And Rav Yossi took in his former wife and her husband and took care of them. And he actually said, there is a great mitzvah to take care of a woman who had once been your wife, even when you're divorced. Because, you know, she was still your wife, and therefore there's still a responsibility. So he actually took care of his divorced wife and her husband. I'll tell you another story about a very great, this is interesting, I don't really know the dynamics here. There was a very, very great Rosh Hashiva. And for some reason, I don't know why, he and his wife got divorced. And then years, he never remarried. Years later, he got cancer. I remember this, I was a law student in Boston. And I remember this Rosh Hashiva. I didn't know of him then. I didn't know who he was. Now I know that, gee, I was looking at this, one of the great Rosh Hashivas in the world. But I remember he was in Boston for cancer treatment. He came from Bnei Brak. And his wife, they had gotten divorced years earlier, she came back to remarry him, to take care of him at the end of his life. So apparently, you know, it's hard to know what went on. It could be they loved each other, they just couldn't live together for a while. You know, I don't know exactly what the dynamic was. But she wanted to be with him, she wanted to take care of him, and she came back to him. Baruch Hashem, he wasn't a Kohen. If he would be a Kohen, that would be some problem.
She wouldn't remarry, because if she were married, then they
that's correct. If she would have, that's correct. Neither of them remarried. Yeah. Right, you're correct. If she would have remarried, she would not have been able to go back to him.
Are there any other restrictions for people getting married outside of the issues of Kohanim?
Well, yeah, you can't marry a mamzer. You know, there are you know issues like that. A mamzer, so there are certain restrictions. And of course, in this day and age of reform conversions, you have to be very careful. You think somebody is Jewish, they may not be Jewish. So you have to be very, very careful of that. And this can already be several generations. I mean, you can have somebody who thinks they were born Jewish, and their grandmother, you know, converted reform or something. So you do have to, unfortunately, do some investigation that you didn't have to do in the past. Okay, so this is the ksuva, right? So the ksuva may take different forms, but the ksuva is read publicly between part one and part two. It's read publicly. Now this raises some interesting questions about reading the ksuva. Now reading, by the way, is not a requirement. You have to sign the witnesses sign the ksuva. It doesn't have to be read, but the custom is that it is read. Just so people know there's a ksuva here. Now here, let me raise some interesting questions about this that may or may not be relevant. You need to talk to your rabbi about this. The text of a ksuva is different depending on whether a woman is a virgin or a non-virgin. If the woman is a convert or a woman is divorced or etc., the wording is different. So the big question that people...
It's on the ksuva?
It's on the ksuva, absolutely. Now.
So let me explain.
Now, the reason is because the amounts are different, right? Because a virgin gets the 200 zuz, a non-virgin is only 100 zuz, right? So... Yeah, that's right.
So how much do you get?
The non-virgin. All converts are assumed to be non-virgin. Yeah. So, in the milieu of Chazal, the non-Jewish world was promiscuous. Whether there could be exceptions, you know, is a question. But that's so. Here is the issue that people face a lot. People, you know, again, this is a real issue, and that is, hey, you know, I'm a Baal Tshuva, I'm a Balas Tshuva, you know, I've reformed, I'm getting married, reformed in a positive way, I'm getting married in front of all sorts of religious people. Does there have to be some public announcement that I'm not a virgin and the like? Now, the truth of the matter is, a lot of people are not following the ksuva. If you've ever heard the ksuva read, it's kind of... Most people don't follow it, but sometimes... You'll have those rabbis who are, you know, eagle-eyed, and they want to hear, and the like. So there are different ways of handling this. And again, I'm not going to give you a psak because you need
to
talk. One way to handle it is this: although the ksuva must be written properly, it doesn't have to be read the way it's written. So if I'm a skillful rabbi, I can do a little improvisation, meaning to say, I will read virgin when it says non-virgin. And so what? As long as the ksuva is written properly, we don't care how it's read. So that's going to be fine. But that does have a little bit of a problem, because where does the married couple keep their ksuva afterwards? Now, if it's an artistic ksuva, they sometimes hang it up on the wall.
What then happens is
some Shabbos guest, some yeshiva boy, you know, goes over there, starts reading the ksuva. Yeah. You know, so
have it in your bedroom. Like if you really need to display it, why not just have it in your bedroom?
Yeah,
why have it in the dining room?
Because sometimes it's very artistic. They want. Okay. Now there's a second solution that some poskim say is the following, and again you have to talk to your rabbi about this. As long as nobody is deceived, as long as the chassan and the kala know each other's status, you can write the ksuva any way you want. You can actually write the ksuva as long as the parties are not being deceived. The ksuva is a contract, and you cannot deceive a party to say, you know, you're something if you're not. But nobody else, it's nobody else's business. So according to that opinion, not only can you read the ksuva as if it's a virginity ksuva, but you can actually write the ksuva that way as well. But again, talk to your rabbi. Some rabbis will not. Almost every rabbi, maybe every rabbi, will permit the ksuva to be read that way. But whether they will permit the ksuva to be written that way, that's much more controversial. Yeah.
Why there's always so much issue on the women being virgins or not virgins? No one kind of is writing anything about the guy.
Yeah.
He could have been anywhere, really.
Well, you know, it is a very, very good question. You are correct. There is no halachic concept of a man having to be a virgin. It is only applicable to women. Part of it, frankly, is based on physical reality, that the virgin versus the non-virgin reflects itself in a physical situation that would not be the same for a man. But it is a good question. It is a good question. I can't say I have a 100% convincing answer. But again, this issue about how to write the ksuva is a very, very important issue. And this would also apply to convert, this would apply to all sorts of details, which can either not be read, or they can even not be written, if everybody, as long as the chasen and the kala, know the status of everybody. Okay, but that is reading the ksuva. After the ksuva is read, we fill up a second cup of wine, and seven brachos are recited under the chuppah, seven blessings. Maybe we'll talk about those blessings next time. And then the chassan and the kala go into a room for seclusion. Now, here, again, I want you to understand this. We think the marriage ceremony is over with the seven brachos. That's not true. Part two is the seven brachos and the seclusion room. That is part two. And the seclusion room is based on, they eat something together. They eat something together. And this is what is called, symbolic, it's symbolic consummation, meaning they share their home together, they eat together, they talk together, and there are witnesses who have to make absolutely sure that nobody can go in or out. They even have to check there's no hidden entrances or windows or escape hatches. They have to look. They have to look. They have to look under the bed to be sure that nobody's there to watch, etc. So it's not actual consummation, but it is what is called bringing the kala into his home, and that is why halachically, not everybody does this. It is important that the so-called yichud room belong to the chassan, at least temporarily, that when you sign a catering contract for an extra nickel or an extra shekel, you rent that room for an hour, so it is the chassan's room, because the concept is he's bringing the kala. Remember the time of the Gemara? He would bring the kala to his home. The thing that takes that, the ceremony that replaces that, is taking her into the cheder Hayichud, and that is why you need witnesses to see that that happened. So this is what is called symbolic consummation.
Could it be a hotel room?
It could be a hotel room as well, but that would be normally later. Normally at the wedding.
It could be the same room that they're staying in.
Sure.
But if you're not in Israel, it's
all coming in to buy a room.
Most synagogues wherever you're getting married, they have a room. They have a private room. It's not only in Israel that they have a room for a chassan. Any Jewish place that has weddings knows they have to have this room. Now, it's interesting that Sfardim don't have that. In fact, they consider the final marital act to be the consummation later that night and after the wedding is over. But Sfardim consider the Ashkenazic custom to be very coarse, as if there's kind of a consummation at the wedding of sorts. So Sfardim do not have the yichud room. Sfardim have the seven blessings under the chuppah, then they go to the wedding meal right away, and the final stage is the private consummation that the bride and the groom have. But Ashkenazim do have this thing called cheder hayichud, how long do they have to be in that room? Between 7 minutes to 9 minutes, not that long. Usually they stay longer. or they take pictures. There's all sorts of other customs. The truth is, photographers have more input in weddings than do rabbis today. That's why it may be almost an hour sometimes before the bride and the groom come into the wedding meal. But don't blame the rabbis. We just said they have to be there 7 to 9 minutes. Okay? So I guess the central insight I want you to understand is that the Jewish marriage ceremony is a combination of Erusin and Nisuin that are combined in one package. And then, of course, there are 7 days of rejoicing. That's like post-wedding. That's, and in each of those days, Sheva Brachos are recited as well. But that's a post-wedding thing. Okay? All right. So we'll continue this next week. Have a good week, everybody, and a good fast. And, well, Mr. Hashem, you know, maybe there won't be a fast. The Beis HaMikdash can come tomorrow, Mr. Hashem. If not, may this be the last Asara B'Tavis that we have to fast. Okay, take care.